October 2nd is the first meeting of the New York City Safe Energy Coalition. We have a three-pronged approach to safe energy. Close the Indian Point nuclear plant, grow the renewable energy industry, and make our buildings more energy efficient. That's Thursday, October 2nd at the New York Environmental and Justice Law Project. Join us at 6:30, 11 Park Place, Suite 701. That's near Broadway and near City Hall. Meeting starts at 7 p.m.
Hi, I'm Mario Murillo, Interim Program Director of WBAI and an occasional co-host on The Morning Show with Michael G. Haskins. In anticipation of the forthcoming fall membership drive, which kicks off next week, I wanted to invite all of you to join us this Thursday morning at 7 o'clock for an on-air give-and-take about community radio in New York City and the role of WBAI in today's complex digital media environment. It'll be an opportunity to discuss the future of WBAI and brainstorm creative ways to move forward. That's this Thursday morning during the WBAI Morning Show at 7 a.m. We'll be joined by WBAI General Manager Bertolt Reimers and, of course, all of you with on-air phone calls. And if you can't be there this Thursday, feel free to message me on Twitter at MarioRadio99 or send me an email at MarioRadio@WBAI.org. For now, thanks for your continued support and keep on listening to WBAI 99.5 FM Pacifica Radio and online at WBAI.org.
Check it out, y'all. This is Freddie Sheffield. You're listening to WBAI 99.5 FM, New York, New York. Listener sponsored Free Speech Radio. Come on out every first Monday and check out Too Raw for Radio Comedy Experience. We got a reception that goes down at 6:30 p.m. and 8 p.m. is showtime. Tickets and info is available at www.wbai.org. And the place to be is the WBAI headquarters located at 388 Atlantic Avenue, Brooklyn, New York. See you there.
That's right. Monday, the first Monday of the month. Laugh night. Big laughs at WBAI. And you should tune in 7 o'clock tomorrow morning for Mario Murillo and Bertolt Reimers. Probably more big laughs here at WBAI New York. It is precisely midnight. And coming up in 90 minutes, Hour of the Wolf with Jim Freund, followed by Lister, Burn, Baby, Burn, Clappers. But right now, it is time for our weekly Robert Knight Memorial Broadcast of Earthwatch. Please stay tuned.
Tonight's Earthwatch Classic Broadcast features a conversation between Robert Knight, Neil deGrasse Tyson, and Michio Kaku on their books, Meteor Showers and the State of Scientific Research and Potentials.
Lies you had told, and the lies you had sold out. Perfect song for Augusto Pinochet. This is Earthwatch on WBAI New York. I'm Robert Knight. Happy Thanksgiving, everybody. Tonight we're going to look at space and do some other things. Phone number is area code 212-209-2900. And among the things we're going to do is celebrate the fact that for the first time permanently, finally, here in what we know as Master Control, also called Control Room 1, there has now been installed in perpetuity an internet-capable phone line. We have battled and struggled long and hard for this technical improvement so that WBAI can be on the edge of the 21st century. And I'd like to give acknowledgement to our acting operations director, John, for taking to heart that need and finally properly installing a POTS line, as we call it in the trade, a plain old telephone service line, which means that during this program and on other programs, producers will be able to be live in more than one way, on the microphone and on the internet. And if during this program or at any other time you wish to communicate that way, I am R Knight, R-K-N-I-G-H-T, at escape.com. In fact, you might want to send some email during the show. One of the things that is nice about it is that we are able to share information, get information, on a very timely basis. And one of the perks of being online is the wealth of information available. Now, part of it has been used to track space. A week or so ago, we spoke about the Leonid meteor shower. It was thick, and it might be even thicker next year. No satellites are reported down, although some of them are now coming out of hiding. But there was an unexpectedly strong phenomenon associated with the Leonids as they crashed through the atmosphere, ionizing air molecules. They create additional ionic mirrors or reflectors for radio waves, short waves. And ham radio operators and shortwave listeners around the world reported extraordinarily good hearing during the Leonid meteor shower. So there's one consequence. One of the sources of information that I use is the SAT-ND report, S-A-T-ND. And a fellow journalist, a very strange journalist named Peter Klonowski, produces that. You can take a look at it at the web address sat-nd, sat-nd.com/news. And there you find timely updates on what is happening with the constellation of satellites, some hundreds of them that are operational. An interesting point in the most recent report is that 80% of the Russian satellite fleet is about to become inoperable. They're about to end their useful lifespans. Russia, of course, is cash-starved and unable to launch as many rockets as they have done during the ascendancy of their space program. As a matter of fact, one of the dirty tricks the United States is doing is going through the back door and getting ready to make a deal with the government of Ukraine to take away some business from Russia for all of the launches and support activities that will be needed for the International Space Station. It's one of the items that has just been reported on sat-nd.com. But Peter Klonowski is a little weird, and he occasionally includes an item called omelette du fromage. Sometimes it's humor, and other times it's just oddities. This one is so interesting, I thought it worth sharing. This is described as some information in case you needed further proof that the human race is doomed. Here are some actual label instructions on consumer goods. And they are as follows. On a Sears hairdryer, do not use while sleeping. On a bag of Fritos corn chips, you could be a winner. No purchase necessary. Details inside. On a bar of Dial soap, directions. Use like regular soap. On some frozen dinners, Swanson. Serving suggestion, defrost. On a hotel provided shower cap in a box, fits one head. On a tiramisu dessert, do not turn upside down. Where is that instruction printed? Well, of course, on the bottom of the box. On a Marks and Spencer bread pudding, product will be hot after heating. On packaging for a Rowenta iron, do not iron clothes on body. On some children's cough medicine, do not drive car or operate machinery. On Nitol, the sleeping pill, warning, may cause drowsiness. On a Korean kitchen knife, warning, keep out of children. On a string of Chinese-made Christmas lights, for indoor or outdoor use only. On a Japanese food processor, not to be used for the other use. On Sainsbury's peanuts, warning, contains nuts. On an American Airlines packet of nuts, instructions, open packet, eat nuts. On a Swedish chainsaw. Do not attempt to stop chain with your hands. To which I cannot help but add our own motto here at WBAI for all of our technical staff. The WBAI operations motto is, do not stare into laser with remaining eye. This is Earthwatch. I'm Robert Knight. Holiday time. When we come back, three guys talking about space. My name is Robert Knight. This is Earthwatch. You're tuned to WBAI New York on a quiet beginning of a holiday. And like to announce that this Friday is going to be a very special occasion for the fight to liberate people from repressive drug legislation, the Rockefeller drug law vigil. It's the worst in the country. And we're going to change it. The William Moses Kunstler Fund and some other people have been involved in an ongoing vigil that takes place at Rockefeller Center every Friday from noon to 2 p.m. And last week it was at Brooklyn Supreme Court. And throughout, families, members of the families of victims who are sent away for a quarter of a century for trivial drug infractions, dispossessing families, burdening the state needlessly. That's been going on. Randy Critico's been doing a lot of work. Margie Ratner and the fund and everybody involved, and especially the families. And what's special about the vigil this Friday is that it being a holiday, children of the prisoners and members of their families will also be there. So the spirit of things will be expanded quite a bit, and I'd like to ask you to join in. For information, you can call 924-6980, the Kunstler Fund, 924-6980. We're going to do tonight, in addition to preparing for that, is hear a little bit of talk about space. Excerpts of this have been heard, but it's never been heard in its entirety. It's a fine conversation with some folks who know about space. I'm speaking of the director of the Hayden Planetarium and of Dr. Michio Kaku. And it's a special interview. I have the pleasure of hosting and taking part in it. This is Earthwatch. I'm Robert Knight. Let's just get right into it. Greetings and welcome to this special edition of a program that we might call Earth Explorations Watch. It's a program that monitors the scientific discoveries on the planet Earth and beyond. My name is Robert Knight. I'm the host of a program called Earth Watch on WBAI in New York City. And on this day, we are surrounded by stars. And by that I mean a very spectacular pair of people, a physicist and an astronomer, who are keeping their eyes to the sky. With us is the director of the Hayden Planetarium in New York City, Neil deGrasse Tyson, and professor of theoretical physics at the City College of New York, Dr. Michio Kaku. They are also literate. In addition to being scientists, each has written an important new book. Dr. Tyson is the author of a new collection called Just Visiting This Planet. Merlin answers more questions about everything under the sun, moon, and stars. Michio Kaku, of course, is the author of the book Hyperspace and the new book Visions, which is just currently becoming available in paperback. That book is about how science will revolutionize the 21st century. Dr. Tyson, I guess I'd like to begin with you. That is to say, with this collection of Merlin questions and answers, who is Merlin and what is that about?
Merlin is simply a pen name I use for a question and answer column that I write for a magazine called Stardate, published out of the University of Texas. Perhaps most people who have ever heard of Stardate would have know of them through their daily radio spot. Many fewer people know, perhaps, that they publish a bimonthly magazine called Stardate of the same name. And in that magazine, questions are solicited from the readers, and they all come to me. And through the pen name of Merlin, I answer each one of those questions.
The character Merlin, who answers these questions, claim is from the planet Omniscia, a planet of total knowledge?
Yeah.
and hangs out with many famous entities, Santa Claus, as well as fictional entities like Galileo and Einstein. And
Einstein for me. Yeah.
The Merlin character, it's not the Merlin you may be familiar with from Arthurian legends. This is a different Merlin. There's more than one Joe in the world. Well, this is another Merlin.
It's Neil's alter ego.
Merlin, I tried to create a profile for Merlin that enabled it, the Q&A column, to be a much more fun thing to do than simply straight out answering questions. So this Merlin character has lived for all of Earth history and has observed major scientific discoveries as conducted by humans on Earth. So when someone writes in and asks, "Dear Merlin, I don't quite understand gravity," Merlin would then recall conversations with Isaac Newton in Isaac Newton's backyard in Lincolnshire, England, for example. And of course, since Merlin has already lived all of his past and has asked questions of all kinds of scientists throughout history, it's not likely you would ask a question that Merlin hasn't already asked himself.
Merlin is most fascinating, and I wonder if you glean information from what people are thinking about by their questions. Are there answers within the questions?
Well, the first thing that is perhaps it's playfully disturbing, and that is more than nearly half the questions that I get have catastrophe as their theme. Someone writes in, "Dear Merlin, what would happen if the sun blew up? Or what would happen if Earth fell into a black hole? What would happen if the universe turned inside out? What would happen if we lost our ozone layer?" Some psychologists need to look into this, because I don't know what's going on. What I often try to do is, some questions have simple answers, but they can be fleshed out in ways that significantly add to their value. One such question was, someone was concerned about whether what would happen if a black hole fell towards Earth. And so in one of the answers, I created a scenario where one might perform that experiment. And so I put him standing there in a black hole-proof suit, of course, and he pulls a black hole out of his pocket and drops it, and, a golf ball-sized black hole. Well, it turns out a golf ball-sized black hole contains as much mass as you might find in the entire Earth. So the Earth and this black hole fall towards each other, and they meet somewhere in the middle, and the black hole systematically funnels the contents of the Earth into itself until it grows to perhaps be the size of a lime. And in the end, I tell the chap, I say, "You might have regretted this experiment halfway through." But
it has holes in it.
A black hole can really ruin your day.
Yes, a black hole in the wrong place at the wrong time. So I just, so it's a collection of playful, though very serious, scientific answers to what amount to, in many cases, very serious scientific questions.
Well, with the solid scientific basis of your answers, I think it would be interesting if, as you suggest, a psychologist were to look into the catastrophism that permeates the questions, as well as your invisible friend, Merlin.
Yes.
Also with us is Dr.
Just invisible to you, not to me.
I stand corrected. Also with us is Dr. Michio Kaku. He is also a man of vision. That is, in fact, the title of his new book on the bestseller list in the United Kingdom. And it's called Visions, and How Science Will Revolutionize the 21st Century. What were you thinking about, Michio, when you wrote that?
Well, first of all, I make no pretense that I'm on first-name basis with Santa Claus. I don't talk to Einstein in the afternoons. And I have never met King Arthur. However, I have met, through the wonders of radio and the telephone, 150 of the world's top scientists. And I've interviewed many of the people, including Dr. Tyson, including many Nobel laureates, about what the future is going to look like in the next 10, 20, 50, 100 years. And of course, nobody knows the future. No scientist has a crystal ball. I don't believe that you can see the future at all. But the best you could get, I think, is to interview the people who are inventing the future, people who have prototypes in their basement, people who have working models of the therapies, the inventions. And ever since I was a kid, I've been fascinated with the future. And I think every kid, when they first learn science for the first time, wonders What is it like if you could just leap off the earth in a rocket ship? What about robots? Are they possible? What about designing your genes? Is that possible? Well, I'm in a rare situation where I can just get on the telephone and call a Nobel laureate and ask him, at what point can we begin to redesign our genes? I can call the director of the MIT Artificial Intelligence Laboratory and ask him about robots. When will we have robot maids and butlers? And so that's what I try to do in the book Visions, is to compile the hundreds of interviews I've done with all the world's leading scientists to talk about what the future is going to look like. And, of course, the predictions they made, some of them are not going to come true, but I think many of them will, because these are the people who have their pulse on what's happening in the scientific community. And that's what I wanted, because there's a lot of nonsense also about the future. The Sunday New York Times Magazine, about 2 years ago, had a whole issue devoted to the next 100 years. You probably have seen it. The next 100 years, as told by fashion designers, philosophers, interior decorators, journalists, science writers, economists, and there wasn't a single scientist invited to contribute to an issue, a very thick issue of the Sunday New York Times, to the future. And I thought that was shocking, because when I went through the magazine, it was all garbage, just nonsense masquerading as what the next 100 years are going to look like. And so I thought I would try to remedy that by writing the book Visions.
Well, one of the things that it seems to me is common to both of your most recent literary efforts, that is to say, Dr. Neil Tyson's Just Visiting This Planet, Merlin Answers More Questions About Everything Under the Sun, Moon, and Stars, is published by Doubleday under their Main Street Books imprint, and Visions, which is published by Anchor Books, is a certain Promethean impulse to bring science to people who do not yet know how much they love science. Is that any of your motivation? How do you think the interface between the public and that knowledge is transpiring these days?
Yeah, I think if you look at the rate at which science is happening, the rate of scientific discovery, I just performed this exercise a few days ago. I was in the Princeton Department of Astrophysics Library, where I have a visiting appointment, and I looked on the wall of Astrophysical Journals, which is the leading research journal of the field. And I looked at how much shelf space the journal took up, starting from the very first issue in 1895 up until the latest journals. And I asked myself, well, where is the midpoint of this shelf space? And I found the midpoint of the shelf space, and it occurred in 1985. So another way to say this, if we assume that the quality of research is pretty much consistent, which we could argue in another show whether it is or isn't, but making a base assumption that quality of research is consistent from year to year, it means that the halfway point in our accumulated knowledge of the universe took place 13 years ago. So as much has been published in the last 13 years as has been published in all previous time leading up to that. So it means science is happening at a staggering pace. And it's to the point where scientists can't even keep up with all aspects of the field. You have to specialize with far more than was ever necessary in previous decades. And it's good and bad. The good part is it means you can be the world's expert on one little thing, and everyone has to come to you for that advice. But it also means that the public rarely gets the big picture anymore, because they're getting the science sort of funneled through these tiny, narrow channels. It's my hope through Just Visiting This Planet, and by the way, I've read Professor Cockrum's book, Visions. In each of those books, we're trying to bring much more than one dimension of science to the public, trying to synthesize what the state of the subject is today and see how that'll affect our thinking tomorrow. With that effort, it's my hope that science literacy can take another notch forward, because more than ever, and this has been said for many decades, but we really mean it now, more than ever before, science will be impacting how you conduct your everyday life as we go forward.
Dr. Kirku, What is your take on the this exponential growth of knowledge that Neil's talking about?
Well, I think he's absolutely right. If you go to any physics library, before World War II, the accumulated volumes of Physical Review is about, about 2 inches per year. Just 2 inches per year. Because the United States was a scientific midget before World War II. Then after World War II, we inherited all these German scientists. All these German scientists came flooding into the United States, and all of a sudden, after 1945, Physical Review explodes. So that if you take a look at the output of just 1 year, just the output of 1 year, it's about like, about 10 feet. Okay, so going from 2 inches to 10 feet just within a very short period of time shows you this explosion that that Neil was pointing out.
Is the science being done by and large by people of wide interests such as yourselves, or to what extent does the industrial machine, the military, the corporate, the needs of institutions flavor science today as opposed to the free-range discovery that might have existed in earlier centuries?
I think with the pressures of meeting the bottom line in corporate America and the pressures that investors have placed on publicly owned corporations, I think that that will always put pressure on the R&D side of the house in favor of something that can be practical tomorrow rather than in 5 years, for example. And so that's a little bit worrisome. I think a good case in point there was Bell Laboratories, where for ever since they were born, they had the luxury of doing science. It could have some peripheral relationship to communications, but you allowed scientists to be creative through the flow of their own creative juices. And in that, you had tremendous creativity come forth. The moment somebody says, I don't care what you do, but in the end, this widget has to come out, or you end up you're losing touch with the actual creative impulse that enables discoveries to be made. So I think in academia might be the last place you can have free rein as to what you can think about and get paid doing. If that goes away and everything is only considered for practical purposes, you've closed off whole avenues of thought and whole avenues of discovery that may one day have an application far greater than anyone would have imagined at the time. Some good examples of that in the 19th century is, I think it was Faraday, who first passed a wire through a magnetic field and saw that current was introduced in the wire. And people said, oh, that's a cute little toy, but of what good will that serve, you know, humanity? And in fact, that's how power plants create energy. You're passing wires through very powerful magnetic fields, inducing a current. And it's the foundation of our modern-day electricity production. So I think in terms of how broadly scoped scientists are or the public is, I think part of the breadth of that scope needs to enable a person to stay as open-minded as possible for the role a discovery could play as we go forward.
And in fact, just last week I was in London, and I visited Faraday's laboratory at the Royal Institution. And I saw the laboratory where he built these machines, and there's a famous story they tell there. One day, William Gladstone, Prime Minister of England, came by to visit these machines that Michael Faraday had invented, and William Gladstone kicked these machines, and he said, Mr. Faraday, of what use will these machines have for the empire? Well, Mr. Faraday didn't know what to say, so he collected his thoughts, and he finally came back, and he said, Mr. Prime Minister, I know not of what use these machines will have for the empire, but I do know one thing. One day you will tax them. And about 50% of the world's wealth is related to electricity. Computers, WBAI, FM, radio, lasers, the internet, electricity, lights, all of that, essentially coming out of the machines that energize the industrial electrical revolution.
They really mean it when they harness the electron.
Mm-hmm, that's right.
This is WBAI New York. I'm Robert Knight, and I'm surrounded by a binary star system. It is in the form of Dr. Michio Kaku and Dr. Neil Tyson, the latter the director of the Hayden Planetarium in New York City, the former a professor of theoretical physics at the City University of New York, and the author of Visions, How Science Will Revolutionize the 21st Century. And Dr. Tyson is the author of Just Visiting This Planet, published through Doubleday. Now, one of the things about science is that it is immediate. It is not... one of the things that your books bring out is that science is accessible. It's like taking a university course in the order of interesting things. One of the most interesting things, I think, for people right now is that amazing things are happening in the sky. I refer specifically, since astronomy is the intersection of these books, to the bright lights in the sky that are coming our way. The Leonid meteor showers.
Oh, yeah. Well, in a few weeks, more specifically on the mornings of November 17th and 18th, the Earth will, in its normal orbit around the sun, will plow through thousands of tons of meteor debris left over from a comet, Comet Temple-Tuttle, which still exists as a comet, but will be passing through its orbit relatively close to the head of the comet, where the maximum amount of debris can be found. And by the way, in any typical meteor shower throughout the year, that's exactly what we're doing. So that alone is not so, it's not particularly newsworthy, except that this particular path through the comet's orbit, brings us sufficiently close to the head of the comet that there may be as many meteors as 5,000, 10,000 per hour. On any given night, if you're staring up at the night sky, probably in the summer you did this, not in the winter when it's cold out, but in the summer, nice lazy evening, and you're looking up, just chilling out under the stars, and you might see a meteor every couple of minutes. Now imagine hundreds per minute, thousands per hour. This is what the Leonid meteor shower has brought to us at 33-year intervals going back through time. 33 years happens to be the orbital period of the comet that's responsible for it. And so right now we're right in phase with the head of the comet. And but you have to be in the right place at the right time. And we think it's best viewed in the Far East rather than in the United States. But you can bet I'm going to be awake looking in the early morning hours of those 2 days just to get, even if it's a fraction as interesting as what we expect the peak to be, it'll still be far in excess of what you would normally get out of that meteor shower. In fact, shower is an inappropriate word. It'd be a meteor storm. And, of course, many people are worried about this because we've got 600, 1,000 odd satellites in orbit around the Earth. And here come these tiny meteor particles slamming in.
Now, by the way, at this point, some of our listeners may be thinking about that movie you saw, Deep Impact and Armageddon, and may be saying to yourself, oh, my God, there's going to be meteor impacts in November 17th and 18th, right? However, I saw both movies, and I thought they were very entertaining. They were both number one movies in the United States. However, I had to cringe a few times when there were some really big scientific mistakes that were made. So, first of all, I thought the movies were done very well in terms of special effects. I love that scene in Deep Impact where there was this tidal wave a mile high hitting the World Trade Center. That was the money shot, as they say. And it was great seeing this tidal wave hit the World Trade Center because that's what meteors can cause if they hit the ocean. They will cause a mile of water, a stream of water a mile high, that'll then inundate most of the east coast of the United States if one hits into the Atlantic Ocean, right? However, in Armageddon, we had a meteor, a comet that was the size of Texas. Now, when they said that, I said to myself, give me a break. The size of Texas would kill the dinosaurs was something maybe, what, 10 miles
10
across?
10 miles across.
Yeah,
yeah.
Would kill the dinosaurs, and that's why we're here today on WBAI radio. They're not dinosaurs in WBAI. They're mammals on WBAI. Is because something 10, 20 miles across hit the Yucatan of Mexico 65 million years ago. So something the size of Texas would be enough to crack the crust of the Earth. So I don't think we're going to see that, and we would have already seen such a comet or meteor before.
What are the possibilities of large fragments? Are there distribution curves that show what we might get by sniffing the tail of this comet?
Yeah, the basic sort of back of the envelope estimates for what the distribution curve is, which more precisely or less opaquely stated, how many media particles of one size compared with another. Getting back to the one the size of Texas, that would have been discovered a couple hundred years ago.
So you mean a thing that's shaped like the state and it's flat like a map?
the big bad one in Armageddon that Bruce Willis needed to save the Earth from, that would have been discovered a couple hundred years ago. And why do I know this? Because there are already the biggest of all asteroids in the solar system are about that size, maybe a little smaller, and we've discovered those 200 years ago. This would have been an easy pick. For this comet, however, we'd expect most of the particles to be, you know, from a golf ball size on down. Many, many more will be the size of a grain of sand, but that's all it takes to leave a very visible streak across the sky. Something the size of a marble could light up a book you're reading temporarily while it became a glow from the shockwaves and frictional heating as it entered the atmosphere. So there'll be many more small ones than big ones. That's always true. But this comet and its debris is not something you need to worry about rendering humans extinct. There are other asteroids out there that we're trying to track that are a kilometer across that would do serious damage.
That have our name on it.
That have our name on it, and we don't know that yet. But we'll find it one day. This, just go out and enjoy yourself. Dress warmly and hang out under the stars.
For the Lumineds.
Mid-November?
Yeah, November 17th and 18th, early morning hours. After midnight, for sure.
In what direction might one in the North American hemisphere look?
Meteor showers are named for the constellations that they appear to emanate from. And so in this case, it's the constellation Leo, which looks like a backward question mark in the nighttime sky. You just reference any star chart, you'll find it. And other constellations, there's the Perseids in the summertime, and those appear to emanate from the constellation Perseus. By the way, because these meteors have an emanation point, you can imagine 33 years ago, 99 years ago, when people saw this, imagine streaks all coming to the left and right and above and below a single point on the sky. There was that journey to hyperspace that Hollywood has always been trying to find.
And that screensaver on computers with that inadequate operating system.
Well, there you go. I mean, the nature invented it a long time ago.
Dr. Kaku, you raise an interesting point here, and that is in the part of media that is most financially endowed. These questions or issues are presented in a dramatic form. What's your estimate of the box score of accuracy? You seemed perturbed by some inaccuracies you've seen in movies.
Well, I'm a film junkie, and I like to watch all that stuff. I've seen, I think, every single Star Trek ever made. And in fact, I've been on their Star Trek webpage answering questions from viewers all over the world. And I've seen a lot of the movies coming out of Hollywood. However, one thing I find very disturbing is that all the aliens look just like us. Like on Star Trek, they just have a little makeup on their nose. And I think that's probably because of the Screen Actors Guild union contract. The union contract probably says that a union member must play the alien, right? And so I think that's probably the reason why all the aliens in Star Trek look just like us.
What happened to non-traditional casting? I thought that was...
And in real life, you know, if you take a look at how we became intelligent, you know, it wasn't the fact that we have, you know, monkey-like appearances with two arms, two legs, and what have you. It's because we had basically a thumb that gave us the ability to grab objects. That could have been a tentacle, a claw. In our case, it was the opposable thumb. Binocular vision, so that we can judge distances. But you don't have to have two eyes. You can have three, four, five eyes. But it helps to have eyes or sensors to judge distance. And then a language by which you can communicate with other members of your species when you hunt socially or whatever. And other than that, you don't really need much more for intelligence. So in outer space...
Oxygen. You need oxygen.
Some way of energizing your body.
Right.
But, you know, you don't have to look just like us. And, of course, they're not going to want to mate with us. The aliens from outer space are not going to want to eat us, like on Twilight Zone episode where they leave that book behind that says, "To Serve Man." And the aliens want to serve man by, you know, having it fried or poached or fricasseed, right? But aliens are not going to want to eat us because they're not going to be made out of the same DNA as us. They're not going to want to mate with us also because we're not made out of the same DNA. I mean, aliens are not going to lust after lobsters, and they're not going to lust after us, you know? We're going to be different species, different DNA, and they're not going to look like us, right? And that means that there's a tremendous amount of room for the imagination. And that's why I think Hollywood doesn't become imaginative enough when they start to look at what aliens will look like from outer space.
Mm-hmm. The way I look at it, one of my favorite quotes of many quotes from Mark Twain is the one where he says, first get your facts straight and then distort them at your leisure. what I would rather happen in Hollywood is they first understand the facts. Mm-hmm. Then play Hollywood with those facts to your heart's content. What worries me is when they started out with a misconception to begin with and then try to place a creative idea on that misconception, and you end up going astray from anything that has any relevance to anything at all. Here they are thinking for Armageddon that they need an asteroid the size of Texas to put the world at risk. No, it doesn't have to be that size at all, because as Michio said a moment ago, it could be 10 miles across and you'll put us at risk. It doesn't have to be 400 miles or whatever.
Manhattan could do it.
Easily. And so... and then the people in Deep Impact knew this, and they also remembered that most of Earth's surface is water. So chances are if something's going to hit, it's going to hit water. And by the way, a tidal wave going through lower Manhattan seemed to me to be just as exciting, if not more exciting, than watching an asteroid decapitate the Chrysler Building in Armageddon. Because now there's a whole other cinematic moment you can create. A tidal wave rushing up the streets of New York. That's based on what will really happen, and now they can take it and run with it and have the buildings knocked down like dominoes, have people running up the valleys trying to escape the influx of water, and it created a tremendous, very exciting, thrilling money moment in the film. So if they get the facts straight up front, you'd be surprised how much latitude the science can then give you to make a very interesting plot twists and storylines and the like.
What are some films from the classics or from contemporary that you feel have had a good scientific philosophy?
Well, let me say that I got
a film junkie answer first.
Since I've seen all the B-grade movies and I've seen all the bug-eyed monsters that Hollywood has produced. Now, there have been some real gems coming out of Hollywood also. There is Forbidden Planet, which I think is one of the great classics of science fiction. It's based on Shakespeare, by the way. The Tempest, when we have this man who's marooned on an island. Here, Morbius is marooned on a planet. And the monster does not have to look like a bug-eyed monster. The monster actually was invisible and defied the laws of evolution. And it was a film that was scientifically believable in that sense. And the crux of the movie, of course, is it fooled everybody at the end that the monster came from the human, that it came from the human imagination, that if we are advanced enough, you can have power without instrumentality, that is, power of the mind magnified by instruments. And so here was a movie that bordered on the far reaches of science fiction that was scientifically credible. And I think Forbidden Planet left a very deep impression on a lot of young kids. And that's why even in Manhattan, we have a magazine store called Forbidden Planet, because it was one of the best that Hollywood has produced. And later, it helped to spin off Star Trek. All the main characters of Star Trek, you can see them in the movie Forbidden Planet. The captain, who's kind of stupid, that's Kirk, right? And also the science officer. And the pretty girls, of course, because it is Hollywood. And you can sort of see, as a prototype, all the very basic characters that became Star Trek in the movie Forbidden Planet. 2001 is another movie, by the way, which is also scientifically authentic. Most people, when they watch 2001, think it's just super mystical and metaphysical. Actually, it's quite scientific, because at the beginning of the movie, Stanley Kubrick actually had interviewed Freeman Dyson and many other astronomers, actually, about the best way to colonize the galaxy. And the best way to colonize the galaxy for an advanced civilization is to send probes, robot probes, to land on the moon, because the moon has no erosion and is quite stable. And then you simply sit there and wait for intelligent life to develop. And in the meantime, you create copies of yourself, millions and millions of copies of yourself, like a virus, that are then sent out to other moons in other systems. That way you can colonize a galaxy at roughly the speed of light, a little bit less than the speed of light, like a virus can colonize the human body by hijacking the molecular mechanisms of a cell. You can have these monoliths land on the moon and create copies of themselves and hijack the minerals of a moon. That is the plot of 2001, and that is the most efficient, mathematically efficient way to colonize a galaxy, not with the Enterprise and Captain Kirk and Spock, but with robot probes that are self-replicating. Unfortunately, Kubrick cut the first 5 minutes of his own film, cut all the interviews with Freeman Dyson and other famous scientists, and then the movie became super mystical as a consequence. But it is scientifically authentic, that movie.
Would you include among your pen CinemaCon The Man Who Fell to Earth?
With David Bowie?
Mm-hmm.
Well, I think when he put those contact lenses on and he looked like a lizard, I think that scared a lot of people, seeing David Bowie turn into a lizard. However, I think we should think about that. Aliens from outer space are not going to look like little green men that have lost their hair and have big eyes. Mm-hmm. They could have all sorts of different kinds of architectures.
He was a neighbor, I suspect, just nearby from that Mars. or not.
Some of my friends, I think, are from outer space.
Will, do you have favorites?
Just let me set the record straight. I'm not one of these people who sits in a movie and says, oh, that'll never happen. Oh, that'll never happen. I mean, I watch a movie in its own context. I mean, it reminds me of a movie I saw with a friend, and I was sort of the token scientist in the group. And well, they're watching the first Superman movie. I think Superman 1. I lost count after 3. Superman 1, I think this one. This is the one where there's the earthquake and Lois Lane dies, and for reasons I still haven't figured out, he wants to save her from this death.
Yeah, at that point I thought, good riddance. I never liked that character. At last they got rid of Lois Lane.
It's like, you know, talking as if this were a bad thing.
But so he was clearly distraught. And got really angry, screamed into the heavens, went up and flew backwards around the Earth to the point where the Earth reversed its rotation, time went backwards, and then he had to, like, set it going forward again, and then Lois Lane is alive and he's there to save her. My friend asked me, Neil, could that really happen that way? Okay, I think referring to whether if you reverse the rotation of the Earth. And I'm thinking, at no other time has this person who's sitting next to me asked, could a man with blue leotards on fly through the sky? So why does this piece of the movie trigger such incredulity when nothing else has? So all I'm saying is I see movies with a balanced head, and if they want to make something happen, fine.
You know what burns my cape?
What's that?
Whenever Superman or anyone like that flies from the Earth out into space, they portray it as flying in a straight line. Doesn't angular momentum require that these be spiral?
Oh, well, Superman's immune from all laws of physics, so that's easy. Give me a hard question.
Am I wrong?
However, you know, there is a science behind Superman. I've seen Superman issue number 1, Action Comics,
yeah.
And there it says that it lays out the laws of physics. Superman is from a planet with a heavy gravitational field, lands on Earth, and therefore he can bounce. He can jump. That's why they say faster than a speeding bullet, able to leap tall buildings in a single bound.
Not fly over them,
not
but
fly.
Leap over them.
Leap over tall buildings in a single bound. And when I was a kid, I used to always wonder, well, Superman can fly. Why does he have to leap? And there it is. In the first issue in Action Comics, it lays it out. Superman has to hop. And he doesn't say up, up, and away in the early issues. He jumps like the Hulk. He jumps from building to building.
He succumbs to the inverse square law of gravitation.
Yeah, and it's because of the laws of physics. He is a Superman because he comes from a Jupiter-sized planet with a heavy gravitational field who lands on the Earth. We're weaklings compared to this Jupiter man, and he's able to leap tall buildings in a single bound. So they actually, in the early days, tried to conform to the laws of physics. And then, of course, it didn't sell well, so they said, what the hell? Up, up, and away!
But what gets me is he's out there in space and the cape is fluttering in the breeze, you see, where there's no air in space.
This is Earth Explorations Watch, and we're taking the air out of some science fiction falsity, but also appreciating the science that's underneath it. My name's Robert Knight. I'm the host of a program called Earth Watch. Also here is Dr. Michio Kaku, the host of a program called Explorations. He is also the author of Visions, How Science Will Revolutionize the 21st Century, published by Anchor Books and now available in paperback. Also here is Dr. Neil Tyson, the author of a new book called Just Visiting This Planet. Merlin answers more questions about everything under the sun, moon, and stars, published on the Main Street Books imprint of Doubleday Press. And I think you've started something interesting here, speculation about the nature of life and whether it's ubiquitous or unique to this planet. Dr. Kaku, you were saying that manipulability is important in the development of intelligence and being able to move beyond one's origins. Had it not been for that couple of inches, this planet might be ruled by cats and dogs with the opposable thumbs, which they didn't quite get. The Superman myth posits that by having come from a red planet, a red star, that somehow that has a differential effect. Now, if, as you, Dr. Tyson, have said earlier, that you need an energy source, you need the sun, you need water, as you say, the heat that would maintain water as a liquid. Would, given equal speculative developments of a species on one type of star in the main sequence and a different kind of star, a star that radiates in a different spectrum mainly than the sun, would you expect there to be significant differences? What are your visions of how life might be evolving elsewhere?
I like looking, if you just forget other planets for the moment, let's just look at Earth, where all life on Earth shares some percent of DNA in common. Obviously, the farther removed one life form is from another, the smaller that fraction of DNA is that they have in common, like humans and jellyfish or humans and oak trees. But given that, we look on Earth, which is teeming with life.
Or humans and lawyers.
No, lawyers have no DNA. No. They're definitely aliens.
Just look on Earth, and you see the diversity of life on Earth. If you line up in a row a virus, an amoeba, a jellyfish, a snake, an oak tree, a giraffe, and a human being, and said, you know, all of these came from the same planet. Yet, and look at this thing that slithers along the ground. It's got no legs, no arms, and it eats things five times bigger than its head, and it's getting along just fine. Okay? If you'd never seen a snake, and someone described a snake to you, you'd think the person was pulling your leg. So all I'm saying is, here we are looking to other planets trying to find life, and not to continue to rag on Hollywood ad infinitum, but the life they always find has two eyes, a nose, a mouth, a head, a neck, two shoulders, hands, fingers, and they walk bipedally. And you look at the diversity of life on Earth where DNA is shared. All I'm saying is, if you're going to go to another planet, I fully expect whatever life you find on that planet to be more different from all life on Earth than life on Earth is different from itself. Especially if its genetic encoding, if it has genetic encoding, has some other chemical or biological basis from what you find here on Earth. So when I go around looking through telescopes, or I speak to colleagues who do this sort of thing, I'm content to just find any life at all. Forget the intelligence part, because if intelligence were really important, you'd expect more than one intelligent species to have ever evolved on Earth. But clearly, a whole lot of life does just fine without doing abstract calculus, or physics, or poetry, or music. they're getting along just fine. So we can't put that as a criterion on whether there's life on some other planet. And by the way, there's some stars, we can make some very clear statements about the likelihood of life around other planets. There's some stars that emit copious amounts of ultraviolet light, very hot stars. Ultraviolet is damaging to molecular structure. It breaks apart, these photons come in, it breaks apart molecular bonds. It's unhealthy for life, no matter how you plan to make life, unless you're going to make life underground. And then maybe you can do that. That's fine, too. I got no complaints there. And by the way,
warlocks,
that may be the frontier of the search for life. As we know, we've now found life forms at mid-ocean ridges where there's outgassing from the mantle, and you have this dissolved minerals that precipitate out. They're in very hot liquid. It comes out, reaches the bottom of the ocean. It precipitates out into these chimney structures. Within those chimneys are life forms that thrive on energy that has nothing to do with the sun. So maybe our constraints about what star you're around are irrelevant if the planet or the moon has conditions that give you heat from other ways. Europa, one of the moons of Jupiter, we believe from evidence of recent space probes, has, yes, it's a frozen surface of ice, but we think beneath that ice is a liquid ocean that is heated by tidal stress between itself and the planet Jupiter. If you have a heat source and a heat gradient, you can potentially have life. And you got the liquid water, you got the energy. I can't wait till we go there and go ice fishing, stick a submersible little video cam, and wave to the fishes.
And it's amazing that liquid water is the most precious substance in the universe. Liquid water is the universal solvent. It's the medium in which amino acids, proteins, and DNA can thrive. And in the solar system, we only find it maybe in Europa and on the planet Earth. And you're not going to find liquid water anywhere out to maybe 4 light years from Earth till we hit Alpha Centauri. And what do we do? What do we do with this precious substance? We pee in it. We pollute it. We dump our garbage in it. We dump our filth in this thing, the most precious substance in the universe. And what do we do with it? It really makes you wonder whether or not there's any intelligent life on the Earth. I think perhaps there's no intelligent life on the Earth. Maybe not in space, but certainly not on the Earth.
Dr. Michio Kaku, does the question of varying forms of life emerge strongly in your new book, or the book that is now in paperback called Visions?
Yeah, that's right. I take the book Visions from a 20-year perspective, 50-year perspective, and a 100-year perspective. And within that program, the space program is going to develop in a remarkable way. First of all, within 10 years, we're going to have reusable spacecraft. The Venture Star will replace the space shuttle. It sort of looks like a flying frying pan, like in Star Wars. And they're going to phase out the space shuttle and have a device whereby it's going to cost 10 times less money to send anything into orbit. This will create a renaissance in space travel as we have cheap, reusable spacecraft. And then within a 10 to 20-year period of time, we're going to launch satellites that are space interferometry telescopes. In other words, we're going to be able to photograph or detect Earth-like planets in outer space. Earth-like planets. So far, we've seen 14 Jupiter, humongous Jupiter-plus-sized planets, but we will, within 10 to 20 years, send the space interferometry satellites, which are so accurate, by the way, that if you read the NASA webpage, they say that if you have a lantern on Mars and wave a lantern on Mars, it can be picked up from the Earth. Now, that is fantastic. Waving a lantern on Mars, which can be picked up on the planet Earth, that is the limits of optics of the space interferometry satellite. And there it is on the NASA webpage. You know, they go through the dynamics of what it would take to see Earth-like planets in outer space.
But that poses a biological problem. How can one person do that? Because for such a signal, it's one if by land, two if by sea, and if they're coming from Mars, it's got to be by air. So you're going to need three landers.
Or by space, actually, yes.
And plus, Mars is not a very nice place to wave a lantern because you would explode the atmospheric density. As you saw in the movie Total Recall with Arnold Schwarzenegger, his face starts to explode at the end of the movie. And I was so happy because I said to myself, finally, a movie which gets it right. if you take off your spacesuit on Mars, you will hear that hissing sound.
This is Earthwatch. I'm Robert Knight. Middle of a conversation with Neil Tyson, Michio Kaku. There's even more. And coming up now, the thrilling conclusion in the previously unbroadcast portions of this conversation. You're tuned to WBAI New York, 99.5 FM. Satellites circling the Earth, not the least among them, the Iridium, the 60-some satellites for new cell phones. Bill Gates is planning to further his empire with a Teledesic satellite system, again with scores and scores and scores of satellites. And there's a new phenomenon in the sky, Iridium flashes, that perhaps will stimulate more people to report UFOs. Let's talk about the environment of low Earth orbit, and whether or not it interferes with astronomy, whether or not there are traffic jams, and whether our great opportunities in space are also a problem.
Well, there's a small chance, and let me repeat and emphasize the word small, chance that the Leonid meteor storm that we spoke about a few moments ago could not only just put little dents in, you know, vaporizing dents in the sides of space of the orbiting satellites, there's a small chance that it can actually break them apart. And what happens if you break apart one of the satellites is now what was formerly one particle coming in and hitting a satellite has now become hundreds or thousands of other pieces of a satellite. And so now they go forth, spread around in orbit around the Earth, and they become damaging projectiles unto themselves. And there's a calculation that can show that if more than a critical number of satellites are damaged in just this way, you can create a domino effect and knock out all the satellites at that level in the orbit. And so now it requires some special things to happen. I mean, it's got to hit the satellite in the right way so that it does break apart into many pieces. But you have to watch out, because when that happens, your question would have no meaning.
So, well, actually, it's quite real. Isn't just over the past year, there was a satellite particle that came within a few hundred yards of the space station Mir.
Yes, I remember reading about that. I don't know much more about the story than that, but that there was concern that the Mir is a rather big target up there for asteroids to come in. But the point I was going to make is that with these satellites, yes, it's becoming a pretty busy place up there. And the era of wide field surveys, telescopic surveys of the night sky, are now put in jeopardy because satellites, depending on what time of night, they can reflect sunlight back into your location and just destroy the image you're trying to get of the nighttime sky. Satellites are actually quite fun to look at dusk and at dawn if you're looking for satellites, but if you're looking for the pure night sky, you're not going to get it.
So in other words, if you're watching Melrose Place in Baywatch and your TV screen goes blank on November 17th, you'll know it was a lead-in meteor shower that just knocked out the television signal.
Accident involving large objects.
Yeah, so I think, yes, but a bigger problem than just whether there's a thing in your field of view relates to the band passes in the radio parts of the spectrum that we use to observe objects in the universe. There's been traditionally some band passes reserved for astronomical discovery in the radio part of the spectrum. But now with the proliferation of cellular phones, of beepers, of other telecommunications that takes place by way of radio waves, their astronomical band passes are getting squeezed. And this is, it's a non-trivial problem because once that gets closed off, there are whole branches of astronomy that could no longer be conducted from the surface of the Earth. We'd have to build observatories on the far side of the moon in order where you're radio quiet from all the noise coming from Earth. So it's a big problem. You asked environmentally. These are concerns that we have in the astrophysics community.
The better we can see, the harder it is to look. It's an interesting paradox that we face with the opportunities and some of the intrinsic limits of science. Dr. Kalku, in the surveys that you did for Visions, the 21st Century of Science, is there a parallelism between the space sciences and the terrestrial sciences in terms of growth, or did you find any significant differences in the morphology of each of these fields?
Well, different subjects pace themselves at different rates, mainly because of funding, which is quite sad. In my particular field, like elementary particle physics, string theory, we were beneficiaries of the Cold War. And if we wanted funding for our particular branch of science, all we had to do is go to the Congress and say one word, Russia. And then Congress would say, how much? How much do you want? What are the Russians building? And we got to match those Ruskies. So we would get bigger and bigger atom smashers until, of course, the Russian Empire fell apart. And they were building a huge atom smasher called the UNK, the UNK. It was canceled. And we wanted the SSC, the Super Collider, to match the UNK. Well, the Russians canceled UNC, and so then Congress canceled our SSC. And it showed to us that we physicists were kind of fat. We never had to argue before Congress the merits of why taxpayers should pay money to build this atom smasher. So one congressman asked one of our scientists there, why should we spend $11 billion on this atom smasher? And the scientist didn't know anything about public relations. So he said, well, we're going to discover the Higgs boson. All the jaws hit the floor. You could hear all the jaws hitting the floor. People were saying, what, $11 billion for another goddamn particle? And the last question was, are we going to discover God with this machine? And you saw the movie Contact, where Jodie Foster just hems and haws. It's the most excruciating 5 minutes in the history of cinema, where Jodie Foster is asked before Congress, are we going to discover God with your machine that'll take you to the star Vega? Well, he fudged the answer, the scientists, and they canceled our machine. Now, I would have said something different. I would have said, God, by whatever signs, symbols, and conventions you ascribe to the deity, this machine will take you as close as humanly possible to that deity. We are talking about creation. We're talking about recreating the conditions of Genesis. And unfortunately, that's not...
The Big Bang in particular.
In the Big Bang, yes, right? And that's not the way it was presented in front of Congress. It was, and they canceled our machine. Now, on the other hand...
I'm glad you were busy that day.
And on the other hand, other sciences have fared differently. Like space travel got a lot of money during the Cold War because it was manned space travel. And, you know, there was a famous quote from a congressman. He said, no Buck Rogers, no bucks. That is, no theatrics in outer space, no money for your science budget. So instead of having robot probes like the Voyager and the Pioneer, most of the money did not go in that direction, but went into the heroics, all this theatrics in outer space.
The manned space flight program,
right.
You mean specifically?
That's right. Carl Sagan was on TV once with the astronauts on the anniversary of the Apollo landing. So the Apollo people were saying, yes, it was a great victory for science and whatever. And then the interview on CNN, I was watching it when I was in Paris, asked Carl Sagan, what is your opinion about the science of the Apollo mission? And then Carl Sagan said something which made my jaw hit the floor. He said, basically, there was no science in the Apollo mission. And I said to myself, oh, my God, Carl Sagan's telling the truth on CNN television. I never thought I would hear any scientist say the truth when these Apollo astronauts were right there next to him. And Carl Sagan said it was mainly for publicity. It was mainly for, well, there was a rivalry with Russia. And that's where most of the money went, not for real science, planetary science, lunar science, atmospheric science, which is what Carl Sagan stood for. And I said to myself, my God, that guy has a lot of guts to say the truth on CNN television.
Well, we're in the presence of one, two, three, and many Sagans with us. That's Dr. Michio Kaku, you just heard, author of Visions. And also with us, the author of Just Visiting This Planet, is Dr. Neil Tyson, director of the Hayden Planetarium. And you could not have mentioned the manned space flight program, as NASA calls it, without my asking you, do you have any kind of feeling or thought about NASA's most recent affirmative action hire, John Glenn, who's going back into space?
I thought about this deeply, in fact, and I asked myself, suppose John Glenn, after his first three orbits, the first orbits of an American, I think back in 1962, the Mercury capsule lands in the ocean, they pop the hatch, they shake his hand, say, John Glenn, good job, you put us back on the map, we're back in competition with the Russians. By the way, in 37 years, we're going to put you... In 37 years, we're going to send you back into space. And ask yourself what might go through his mind at that point. He'd be thinking, oh, I'd visit Mars, I'd visit Alpha Centauri, I'd frolic around on Pluto, and all we can do is put the man back into orbit.
Wow.
After 37 years. And I think that is the sort of that's the emperor with no clothes there, because, yes, this mission will be hyped, and I think it's great we're sending him up. I think it's a nice gesture. But if you part the frontline news stories, the bottom of that has got to be a fundamental disappointment that we're not doing more with him than what he did first, and that's just send the man into orbit and bring him back safely. This time he'll land on a runway rather than in the ocean. Okay, that's the only fundamental difference between the two cases, and he'll have a few more orbits than just three. I have mixed feelings about this, because, yes, I remember dreaming in the 60s, and we all saw the same movies, and you know, rotating wheeled space stations with crafts docking. You know, this was part of everyone's dream. And the fact that we're not there is disappointing, but it's also a reality check that space is very hard. It's a very dangerous place. Distances are vast. It's expensive. The reality check is what descends upon you when military incentives no longer drive the budget. Okay, during the 60s, as Michio noted, we're in a race with the Russians. The moment the Russians bail out of the race, you now have to ask yourself, by what means are you going to pry money loose from Congress and from the general public if there's no longer a threat of total annihilation? Without a threat, without a military threat, and without the promise of economic return, my reading of the history of major funded projects tells me that we're basically going nowhere significantly beyond orbit for the foreseeable future. we have to find diamonds on Mars, or there has to be an asteroid headed towards Earth that will knock us all out. And so the word defense now takes on a global meaning, the defense of the species, and we're going to have to go to, ship everybody to Europa or something. But if that doesn't happen, and for the same reason with the super collider getting cut, yes, you can analyze all the reasons that there are budget overruns and all this, and you can make a case that overanalyzes the problem, but in the end, the real problem is there was no defense, it had no clear defense utility, nor economic return that could warrant the expenditure that went into it. And these are the two driving forces that if you have the absence of that, nothing gets funded of any major size.
Yeah, and there's a well-kept secret in the sciences that we don't like to talk about, but there is this dirty little secret that great scientific discoveries sometimes take place during wartime. And it's funded by the generals. When Isaac Newton worked out the laws of gravity, it just sort of sat there, very interesting, fantastic. You know, he got into the Westminster Abbey when he died. But it wasn't until Napoleon endowed the École Normale Supérieure and got Lagrange, Laplace, and the greatest minds of French science to work out the mechanics of cannonballs, the trajectory of cannonballs, the perturbation on the trajectory of cannonballs. The finest minds of French mathematics were set to calculate and solve Newton's laws of motion on cannonballs.
Ballistics, early ballistics.
That's right. That was the impetus for using Newton's laws of motion on the Earth. It wasn't the beautiful orbit of Mars and the fantastic perturbations on Uranus. It was cannonballs.
Flash forward to the University of Chicago, ENIAC. The first electronic computer. It was busy doing trajectories also.
Yeah. So the key question for democracy is, can we maintain science without the Russian threat? And that's a big if, you know, because people are going to cut the budget and they want to give the money to pork and other kinds of silly projects. But we have to keep science funding alive in the United States, even when there's no threat of war.
You raise a very intriguing dilemma here. Security has its place. However, I'd like to know if either of you has personally or theoretically encountered a situation where the intelligence or military directives or premises of the way science is conducted today have led to a limiting of information rather than this great growth that we speak of.
Well, let me say one thing. You know, the gamma ray boosters, which are creating so much excitement among astronomers, we're seeing all these gamma ray boosters. Actually, these boosters were seen years ago by the Vela satellite. We had a satellite called Vela. It was authorized to detect detonations of atomic and hydrogen bombs other than Russia and America. And it picked up two off the coast of South Africa.
It was to enforce the nuclear test ban treaty.
That's right.
In the 1960s.
That's right.
Mm-hmm.
The Vela satellite was set up, and it actually detected two detonations off the coast of South Africa, which are still debatable. But it also picked up huge flashes in outer space. But the Pentagon wouldn't declassify it because it was top secret, blah, 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 blah. So as a consequence, astronomers were denied access to this fantastic information called gamma ray bursters. Also, the Navy had tremendous access to the oceans. They had basically mapped the oceans without telling oceanographers and giving the oceanographers this ocean of information about what the surface of the Earth really looks like. We know more about the surface of Venus and Mars than we do about the surface of the Earth, because the Earth has lots of water on it. So the Navy actually mapped most of the surface of the Earth with submarines, but never told oceanographers, because, of course, we were engaged in submarine warfare. Now it's all coming out. So we have this wealth of information from the Vela satellite about gamma ray bursters, and wealth of information about sonar maps of the bottom of the ocean now, complements of the United States Pentagon.
I'd like to add to that that the astrophysics community has benefited from what was ultimately declassified military information. One obvious recent case is all the technology that went into what's known as adaptive optics. What goes on when starlight comes unobstructed from across the galaxy, it hits Earth's atmosphere, and as it moves through the varying layers of different density and temperature, the path of the star is actually is compromised, and in fact, it ends up blurring the final image you would make of the stars of the star. Now it turns out that the military had figured out how to correct for this problem by actively deforming the mirror of the telescope in an exact opposite way that the atmosphere was deforming the light of the star, so that they perfectly cancel, giving you a sharp image of this of the nighttime sky.
Beautiful.
And it was very cleverly done, and only when that became declassified did the world's astronomers say, whoa, we wanted this all along. And so using, and in fact, many astronomers have been trying to do it, but weren't bankrolled on the level that the military was.
1,000 miles an hour in the galaxy we call the Milky Way. The galaxy itself contains 100 billion stars. It's 100,000 light years side from side. It bulges in the middle, 16,000 light years thick, but out by us, just 3,000 light years wide. We're 30,000 light years from galactic central point. We go round every 200 million years, and our galaxy is only one of millions and billions. This amazing and expanding universe. Now the universe itself, it's on expanding and expanding, and never redirection it can wish. As fast as it can go, the speed of light, you know, 12 million miles.
This Friday, October 3rd, is week 2 of WBAI's Feminist Film Festival, an evening of film and performance on reproductive justice and freedom. We'll show Lori Harris with a vengeance, covering a wide slice of movement history, from early activism to clashes with the right and women of color challenging mainstream feminism. Then, Jennifer Baumgartner's I Had an Abortion. Women of different ages and ethnic groups face the camera and tell their stories. Lastly, live theater. A stage and TV actor, Stacey Linnartz, enacts The Siege, a powerful story of the harassment of a doctor by the far right. For the full 5-week festival schedule, go to WBAI.org. It's all at 388 Atlantic Avenue. Doors open at 6 p.m. for shorts with features at 7:30. The popcorn machine is working. The popcorn is hot. And so is the subject.
Ladies and gentlemen, what's going on? This is Clipper Man, comedian extraordinaire. Thank you for tuning in to WBAI 995 FM, New York, New York. Too Raw for Radio comedy experience every first Monday, y'all. Reception starts at 6:30 p.m. Comedy show starts at 8 p.m. sharp. Tickets and info, www.wbai.org. Every first Monday of the month, ladies and gentlemen, Too Raw for Radio comedy experience, 388 Atlantic Avenue, Brooklyn, New York. Free speech radio.
Good morning. This is Hour of the Wolf, a weekly program dedicated to science fiction, fantasy, enchantment, and the imagination. My name is Jim Freund. This week is part two of a conversation started last week with Dan Parsons. And once again, Veronica Sheamus will not be here, only we didn't expect her to be this time. But we're going to be here. Just stay tuned. I'm Dan Persons, movie reviewer for Hour of the Wolf. I get criticized for continually coming up with theories as to how a movie got made with no shred of evidence that what I'm asserting actually happened. That's a fair cop. They're my own lame brain ideas. I don't pretend they're anything else. I share them anyway because it's a way I analyze a film. It's a way I can look at the elements presented and see where they succeed and where they fail. For instance, I wouldn't be surprised to find out that in the development of the new stop-motion animated film, The Box Trolls, there existed a script in which the main protagonist wasn't Eggs, a young boy kidnapped by the titular box-wearing trolls in infancy and raised in their cozy, grotty, subterranean community, but Winnie, the pampered town girl with an odd obsession about the trolls' alleged deprivations that oscillates between horror and rapt longing. That she would be the star makes some sense. The Box Trolls is produced by Laika, the Oregon animation studio whose previous films, Coraline and Paranorman, featured main characters who took in stride the spooky and occasionally grisly aspects of the worlds they inhabited. If such was the case, it's likely that someone looked over the script, said, "Nah, to Coraline," and engineered a shift of the narrative over to the appealing and stalwart, if somewhat confused by topsider behavior, Eggs. Such a switch would have kept the studio from looking like it was repeating itself. The problem is that you can feel that the creators' hearts are actually with Winnie, the slightly dotty girl who revels in the darker aspects of life, than with the boy who views wearing boxes and scavenging through garbage cans at night as normal. It makes for a film that feels somewhat unsettled. Doesn't help that the very slight storyline is a page straight out of the kids' film playbook. The folk of the town of Cheesebridge live in fear of the trolls' nighttime foragings. Their terror stoked by the local troll catcher, Archibald Snatcher, voiced by Ben Kingsley, who's using the panic to orchestrate his own rise up the ladder of the town's cheese-based economy. Little do any of the topsiders know that the trolls are peaceful, inventive, and harmless, using the fruits of their rummagings to furnish their underground village, and that the trolls' abduction of the infant Eggs, now grown to adolescence and voiced very well by newcomer Isaac Hempstead Wright, was not an abduction at all. After the troll population is decimated following Snatcher's decade-long extermination campaign, Eggs has to join forces with Winnie, voiced by Elle Fanning, to end the horrific crusade and discover the true secret behind Snatcher's plan, which actually isn't all that different from the plan everybody knows about anyway. There's the usual stuff about understanding our differences and some fooling around with the idea of pushing past one's perceived nature. But since the bad guy is also trying to push past his nature in his own way, that gets a bit muddied. Actually, what themes there are here seem to be there just because they need to be, not because the story has any new way to explore them. At least we're not being told it's all about family or friendship, at least not overtly. What there is, of course, is the fantastic Leica stop-motion animation, exquisitely choreographed miniature actors playing through exquisitely detailed miniature sets. Each character's unique personality is expressed through their movement, all the way down to how the box trolls use their cardboard garments to execute cooperative maneuvers. And if the story overall is a dud, there are tons of wonderful set pieces within, including Egg's attempt to mix in with a bunch of partygoers, and a dining sequence in which Snatcher's cheese allergy manifests itself in horrific ways as the character, deep in denial, plays through a pretense of gentility. It's too bad that the whole is less than the sum of its parts, but it's those parts that still make the box trolls something worth seeing. I'm Dan Persons. Remember, we are archiving these reviews over at MightyMoviePodcast.com. And if you love science fiction, fantasy, and horror film, please check out CineFantastique Online at CFQOnline.com.
And I did mention before that given that this is sort of a comeback program, 2 weeks in a row, and being that it's October, it makes this a double feature. It was going to be Celluloid Heroes or this.
Michael Rennie was ill the day the earth stood still, but he told us.
And I really should have run the Roxy version rather than
Flash Gordon. Was there,
this is what came
in silver underwear. Claude Rains was the invisible man. Then something went wrong for Fay Wray and King Kong. They got caught in a celluloid jam. Then at a deadly pace, it came from outer space. This is how the message ran.
Well, this looks like not a typical WBAI's internet connection in the control room, basically stalling, because that's what we're doing. We're listening to an internet feed, and it's basically locked up. But you know what? As I said, it's okay. It was the right song. It was the wrong version. There are wronger versions, like the one from Glee. That's a very wrong version.
No. Unhappy MacNab. No.
Yeah, exactly. why does the Firebird lay its egg? The Roxy version, which is the original recorded version, and with the proper cast, which is to say, Meatloaf, Tim Curry. Unfortunately, no Susan Sarandon, but she only gets one song. No, two songs over at the Frankenstein Place, which doesn't count anywhere near as much as Touch a Touch a Touch Me, which is not being shown at the WBAI Feminist Film Festival. I can't understand why not. Yeah. But the
Don't Dream It, Be It.
Yeah. Well, actually, the theme of the movie would fit perfectly well.
Yeah, I would say so. Yeah,
but that specific song, the visuals of it would have.
I saw the show when it played at the Belasco, the beautiful Belasco, as they would say over the PA.
Uh huh.
At the beginning.
That was the revival.
That yeah.